The Gladiator. We're back. This is The Gladiator. We're going to continue that this great historical story, our retired DEA Special Agent Gerald Chapman. As Gerald go through his life experiences growing up in the South, particularly in Montgomery, during the Montgomery, Alabama, during the height of the Civil Rights era. As Gerald participated in a lot of the movement during that time, Gerald later went on to attend a historical black college where he graduated with a degree in chemistry. Gerald was later recruited by the late Art Lewis into the BNDD, the predecessor of the Drug Enforcement Administration. Gerald joined DEA in 1969, or BNDD, and began his law enforcement career, starting off in Atlanta, Georgia, and later Miami, Florida, where he met and was mentored by the late Calvin Campbell. And as Gerald tells it, during that time, Calvin Campbell, along with himself, Gerald, and others, created the organization known as NABNA. So we're just going to go right ahead and listen to the rest of the historical part of Gerald's story with the DEA.
So I know, I would imagine there's one undercover operational episode that just stands out with you that you did, and you realize that these guys ain't looking out for me, because you didn't really have another black guy to back you up. The majority of the time, I would imagine, you have all white guys, I would say. Is there a situation that you can kind of remember that occurred?
Well, let me say this. At that time, we were working a lot with the state and local people, okay? And even state and local departments didn't have black officers. They were in patrol or uniform. And of course, they couldn't work in their own neighborhoods and stuff. And so, or on the street, even though we did incorporate some of those people to help give some cover and surveillance for it. But within my first year on the job, there were three shooting incidents. And I was involved in all three of them in some shape, form, or fashion. And really, at that point, I'm saying, man, this is what I really signed up for. It made you think. And we were working with actually GBI. Dennis Went and myself were working down in Columbus, Georgia, with GBI and Edgar Moses, and there was cases like that. There are other cases where, when I was even in Miami, working on looking for a fugitive. I mean, we had, I was standing next to one of my partners that got shot. You know, obviously he took a shot in the arm, but still, we were very close together, and that could have gone bad, you know.
Yeah.
So there are several cases, but as you grow old and you learn it from the experience and the training, and we can talk about specific cases, I think, a little bit later, but I would like to talk about how NABNA, these are the things that brought NABNA together, because we knew these issues existed.
Right.
And you really didn't have anybody else to go talk to except somebody who knew exactly what you were dealing with.
And that was somebody black.
And that's why Mikhail Campbell, when NABNA was started, there was Charlie Brown, Calvin Campbell, Pete Davis, Ellis Dean, Gene Johnson, Al Parrish, James H. Williams, and myself. And we decided we just try to put this together, and we put together a panel and a forum to help recruit, help to address the training. I contacted several universities in the criminal justice thing and see about getting some courses, how they can put things with us and help give us some training that will simulate that was being given by headquarters, you know. We did talk to our training people, and that's how the conferences started. It used to be a NABNIC conference and training. And we had a lot of state and local, and we brought a lot of state and local people on board. And as a matter of fact, the Memphis Police Department used to be a very big supporter of NABNIC, because they sent a lot of their people to some of our training sessions.
Right, and I know the majority of them.
And what they did was, and there were other police departments, the Atlanta Police Department, and other police departments around the country that used to send their people, because they had, back in those days, what they called vice squads. And they didn't have necessarily a specific squad to deal with narcotics at the time. The vice squad would deal with prostitution and gambling and drugs, and I mean, everything was in that little squad. And so they thought that was some good training for them and their people to get from us to help them in their departments.
Right.
And as a matter of fact, we went out and did a lot of training for those police departments. Even outside of the training of our training academy, because we were teaching them what we knew. And we also knew that gave DEA or gave NABNA a chance to try to recruit people that we saw and work with to help us out.
Right. Smart. Yeah.
So that's what NABNA was actually formed to do. To help give us a way to, number one, have a communication system to look at issues and problems, how to help us address those. You know, one man can't do it all by himself, but you put these minds together. We had some really good, talented people who gave a lot of contributions in putting the charter together for NABNA. And I had the contacts with Parks Jackson and Howell Law Firm in Atlanta. They wrote it up for us, and but we got a lot of stuff from Al Parrish, who had contact with the ATF, the black agents at the ATF. And it was really about that time, right before that time, there was a lawsuit. This suit was brought about.
And
really, a lot of people got SIGA and NABNA mixed up. They are not synonymous. And it was basically for us to address issues internally. The lawsuit was something separate, but there were a lot of members that were members of NABNA were also a part of the class action lawsuit, because we were black agents. And sometimes some people really got that confused about what was what. And we had a lot of white counterparts who saw that as a backlash. They thought it was all the same. They had no idea. They didn't talk to us about it. And of course, that brought on more dissension, more separation and anger and probably dislike within the among the ranks. You know.
So, explain that further, because I know what SIGA is, and I know what NABNA is. And that's interesting. It's almost like, so they didn't like NABNA because they thought NABNA was the one suing DEA, and how?
Well, you're right. A lot of people thought that NABNA, and they thought that we were forming something. It was kind of like maybe we were some alien foreign entity trying to come in and take over the government. That was the attitude. Now, I was the executive director, first put together the NABNA, and I even wrote a letter and sent it to headquarters. And like, we knew we weren't trying to do anything interpretation. We weren't trying to be undercover. We weren't trying to do anything. We weren't doing anything wrong. And I knew that when the word got out that the black agents were getting together and trying to put together some kind of organization, they thought that, hey. So I wrote up the letter, explained everything, and told them what we were. And we were in support of the agency here. They to do a lot of things, even the recruiting, and then they helped do trainings, all kinds of things. Yeah. I remember getting a letter back that said that, well, first of all, it was, we didn't have permission to start an organization, and the only black organization they were recognizing at that time was Big, Blacks in Government. You know, that was a universal, I guess, U.S. government type of organization where people, that black people who worked in the government was an organization, but they weren't narcotic. They were just everybody.
Yeah.
If you were a clerk, if you were whatever. But we were trying to put together something that was specific for us. I wrote back and told them that they must have misunderstood what I was trying to tell them, that we weren't asking for permission and that we were no different from the Black Police Officers Association or the U.S. Attorneys Association or any other organization. We were professional people and, again, tried to explain. Well, for a long time, we never really got a lot of support from the DEA on that. And finally, after and I guess they must have realized that, or somebody must have realized that, no, we weren't there to do anything, to do anything, do any harm. And they finally came around on board. But just like you and I know, when you first start something, if the wrong way, if it's not pitched right, if there's a miscommunication or misunderstanding, and in my case, in my own opinion, I just don't think people really wanted to understand because all the other turmoil was going on. They only wanted to see what they wanted to see, and they may have drawn some conclusion. Remember now, we didn't have a lot of black supervisors and people on the job that could really, you know, stand toe to toe with the administration.
And, so, and that was kind of was by design, because like you say, if you didn't have people in leadership, it could kind of fall on dead ears, you know.
Well, right. Or it left people to fill in their own void. And you know, the other thing is, when I thought about this in some respect or perspective, you know, in order to be a good undercover agent, and just because you can have a gift of gab and because you can play that role, doesn't mean that you are dishonest or you lie all the time. And maybe when you tell people something about an organization and they figure, well, they got this lawsuit going on, they're trying to tell us one thing, but they mean something else, that they are drawing conclusions without the evidence and they form their opinion and it didn't do anybody any good. It just kind of pushed people away.
So and you explain now. Now explain Seeger.
Well, Seeger was a lawsuit that was brought about by a person by was under the name of Henry Seeger.
Yes.
And it alleges that DEA discriminated against their training, assignments, promotions, and those kinds of things.
Who was Henry Seeger?
Henry Seeger was an agent
a black agent, right?
A black agent who was actually terminated for cause. I don't know. They terminated. He was terminated, and because he was terminated, he was wrongfully terminated. And of course, the court established that the suit that was brought about. That DEA did discriminate in their hiring, work assignments, promotions, the whole work. So that was, and NAPNA did not bring that lawsuit. That lawsuit started, and then we had NAPNA to try to do a support thing for those who were still right. on the job, you know.
Do you know Henry Seeger?
Yes, I do.
Okay. And he was in one office, and what office was he in?
Well, at the time that he was, Seeger had been in New York. He had been in since in Ohio. It might have been Cincinnati at the time that he might have been terminated. But like most of us, he was just moving around, you know.
You mean like going from different office to office, doing undercover work? Is that what you mean?
Well, we all did that part. But he was assigned. He was assigned. I think at the time that he was terminated, he was assigned in somewhere in Ohio. I think it was Cincinnati, if I remember correctly. But he had been. I think he had worked in New York before he went to Ohio or whatever it was.
Right. So pretty much when the black agents were just being shifted around, shuttled around to do undercover work for other majority white agents doing their undercover work that they couldn't do or still make their cases out for, but yet they got promoted. But the black agents who actually did the danger and the work did not. Would you say that's was the case?
I agree. In other words, and a matter of fact, some people, a lot of people thought that we were only hired to do undercover work and not do anything else. Now, and some of this might have been kind of played out throughout the years as observed by different people. We had a lot more black agents, and I know four or five that even came on the job through Atlanta. And the other part, the reason the NAPNA was formed is because we were losing black agents. They were hiring people, but we weren't, there were some people who just could not maintain or stay on the job. And that was for different reasons. Perhaps, and I'm not talking about they got killed. This is where, you know, when you're in an organization, you know, and this is the difference between being a police officer and being a bad guy. You don't have to worry about making sure you're following the rules and regulations and the guidelines and those kinds of things. Well, if you have a black agent, all he's expected to do is go out and buy drugs or work undercover, I mean, obviously, you got to be trained in what the policies and procedures are, how to do those kind of things, and make sure you don't get yourself wound up and tangled up in these things. And we also knew that the discipline for even a mistake is kind of like ignorance of the law is no excuse. Yeah. But we were more disciplined for a mistake than our white counterparts. And to include up to firing. And we lost, I know five or six people just from policy procedure. They either got tangled up into doing things that they should not have been doing, but some of them may not have been criminal, but it was against policy. And, you know, the actions taken against them could have been more severe than if you found some white agents that did some of the same thing. So a very simple case would be the use of an OGV.
That's an official government vehicle.
Mm-hmm. If you, you know, we would use the car to go back and forth to work and doing your work. Some people may decide they want to stop by the store, pick up a quart of milk to go home. And somebody report that. And even if you're passing by the store and you're on your way home, and you pick up the quarter milk and somebody report that could be considered, hey, your car was not used, you're using the car not to go shopping. You're supposed to go directly or home to work, or you got to be on the job doing something.
So the policy is that, but yet some of the black agents got dismissed because of or got written up for violating that policy?
There could have been some. There have been some. Could have been. That's just an example. And that may have happened to one person that I heard about. I'm not so sure. And I'm sure there might have been a little bit more to it. But yeah, I mean, that's just an example.
Yes.
And if an agent was say, okay, you just get a letter of reprimand, you can't do that, it's against policy. Or if they, and I think it kind of depended on the person. And this is, again, looking back and talking, I know personalities and relationships play a lot into some of these things when it shouldn't, you know. If you were a person who, you know, did your job and you didn't go play golf, and most times, believe it or not, we weren't invited. As a matter of fact, we weren't even invited to go to lunch with people, and we worked in the same office, let alone come over to the house on the weekend or go boating with them and all that kind of, you know. It just didn't, and it was right on the heels of all the demonstrations and the integrations of, and people may have had that fear of getting too close to people, you know?
Right. Right. So not only the country was separated, I mean, the agency was too. It's kind of a similar.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Mm. And again, as you talk to some of the people back in those days, some people had never been around blacks before. Some of the agents never been around blacks before. They never worked with a black before. And so we are now stepping into a world where they were, and whether they liked it or not, they didn't know how to deal with it. And if they didn't like it, then hey, there was no hesitation or showing that, hey, we don't want you around. I mean, you could be sitting in a room or office, and they could ignore you like you never sitting there before. I mean, you feel isolated, you know?
Right.
And you,
right.
And you're
right,
out there
right,
doing
right.
something dangerous, and you expecting these same people. Man, if something happened, who do I have?
You ever read that book about Ralph Ellison, The Invisible Man?
Yep, I have. Yep.
Yeah, and that's kind of how it was. They don't really exactly. see you. They don't see you.
Exactly.
They know you're there, but they don't see you.
Exactly.
Yep.
And when you're doing a job like this, it's very dangerous. And trust is it. Trust, having trust and confidence and somebody having your is very paramount in surviving on this job.
Yes. You know? Yes. Okay, so Seeger was filed by Henry Seeger, who was terminated falsely, and then he sued, and he ended up winning the lawsuit, but it included all of the black DEA agents during that time. Can you clear that up for me?
Well, my understanding is, and I have to go back and read it again, is that the lawsuit is in Henry Seeger's, under Henry Seeger, but there were several agents who went into the law firm, and I guess even they talked to the law firm about it. They used his name, but he was enjoined by several other black agents before. He wasn't the only one on that original suit. And that's how it became what they call a class action suit. And and even the black that suit is going on 45 years, and it's still not settled.
Okay, now that's very interesting. I definitely want to highlight this. So, do you remember what year the judgment came down that the class action lawsuit Seeger was actually ruled and in favor of Seeger and other black agents, but yet has nothing ever been finalized or paid in particular?
Well, this is where perhaps some of the things I said about the confusion between Seeger and Nabner. Now, Seeger lawsuit was filed back in 1977. Okay. Now, it probably didn't get really, really started until, and Nabner was incorporated in 1979. Okay. 78 and 79. So they're on the close on the heels of each other, right?
Right.
So the first decision was handed down, and it was won in 1981. I think that, you know, so that, so it was filed in 77. I think the decision, trial and decision came out in 1981 or 82. I have to go back and look at my notes on that. Now, of course, obviously, the agency appealed that, and it was affirmed, like in probably 1988. So from 81, it could have been before that. It could have been affirmed in a couple years past that. So, but there's still going on some disputes right now about. But we do know that we still have an EEO monitoring committee that's still following this lawsuit right now.
Mm. Okay. So, and that's, like you said, 40 years. And does the DEA keep appealing the decision? Or I just really thought that, I mean, I know, but how do the judgment never just... It's over with. How is it? Just keep on going and going and just like that.
Well, actually, what stems from that, and there are other people that have more experience in that because they work on this thing all the time. But what happens is once the agency was found that the lawsuit that was filed, that DEA did discriminate against Black agents in their hiring and discipline and
promotions. Assignments
and promotions and that kind of thing. Well, they came up with, and once they wanted to appeal that, it was affirmed. Now, they also tried to put in some things in place after they were found guilty. So now, in order to really settle this thing, there are some conditions you got to meet. And that's why the EEO Monitoring Committee was put in place. And they had to meet certain mile goals and stones and stuff to, so they can bring this thing to a conclusion. Well, they started running into differences of opinions, or the agency was very lacking in living up to some of the conditions that they were supposed to live up to. And when they didn't, of course, you keep going back to court. You keep going back to court. Time constraints, the judge listened to it, and you have your briefs on both sides, and people supposed to work things out. And again, small things started working out, but it still hasn't fully been worked out to the satisfaction.
Right.
And that's why it keeps going.
Right. But even when I came on the job, in like 91. And I was not aware of Seeger until I went to my first Nabner conference in 1992 in Atlanta. And that's when I got educated about it. And, you know, when you're in office at the time, we had one other Black agent, Hank Baker, Henry Baker, but he died.
Mm-hmm.
And you just didn't really have nobody. I enjoyed going to the conference because I got to know other Black agents, got to meet them, and got to, you know, bounce ideas off and all of that. But if it wasn't for that, I really was in Memphis a long 10 or 12 years. And I was the only Black agent there for a long time. And like you say, You want somebody else, man, to just bounce, to talk to about some of the stuff that go on. well, man, with the NDEA, particularly with promotions.
Well, not only that, with everything else. I mean, even in your judgment, how you mature in cases, we run across things that whites don't run across because they don't do the undercover work that we did. And so when you're a black out there and you can exchange experiences, that helps you grow. Because sooner or later, you may run across something, and if you've got some prior knowledge of how somebody else may have handled that, that gives you another tool in your toolkit to be able to draw from experience so that you don't get caught off guard. You know, we live in a world, and we can live different people because of, unfortunately, the way it is that everybody don't, we can live in the same neighborhood, but everybody don't have the same experience.
Right, same experience.
And the way we all grow is that we exchange these experiences. We can even tell people, we can hear in a conversation if somebody is doing something and they don't think about the ramifications of it. They may think it's okay. And we say, no, you know, you got to watch yourself because you can't do that. It may look like you're doing something out, but that's against the rules and regulations. You know, you can help save somebody. You know what I mean? And not only for that, whether it's about a policy about the agency or whether they're doing undercover work. And you tell people, hey, look, you got to make sure you stay within whistling distance. I'll use that because of my mother, you tell me I can't come outside. So that if something happens, you can have help available to you. In other words, and I have been caught up in this before where I get so involved undercover work and, you know, there's something happens there and the guy said, well, let me just take you someplace. Now, we know good well, I ain't supposed to be leaving that spot there without everybody knowing so we can make sure we have cover there. Yeah. But if you walk out, even if it's down another hall or another building, you know, if there's no way to let your people know where you are, you can't get the help you need.
Right.
And so we tell people, hey, you got to be thinking as you do these undercover operations, that you got to stay within the boundary. I don't care what happens because it's for your safety.
Right. We have your safety.
Yeah. And we've had things like that happen. Where a person would go into a building and because they went out another way and nobody was back there and it didn't end up good at all. Nobody saw him leave and the next thing you know, you find the person that was shot and killed with his own gun. So when you have these exchanges of information, you have these changes of experience, we all grow. That's why you go to training academies and they simulate certain things to help you with your training. Well, that never stops. You go in that academy, your training stops. It doesn't stop until the day you hang that gun and badge up. I don't care what position you have. You know, you never stop training. You never stop training. So,
I'm going to say this. When I came on, Cal Campbell had already passed in Memphis. He passed in 1990, and I remember seeing it in the paper in Memphis that he had passed. Mm-hmm. And it was about a year later before I made it on the job.
Okay.
But, you know, I would have liked to have seen him and, you know, at least worked for him for a moment before he did pass. But I'm sure he could have made my, you know, transition a lot easier than to DEA. But you're right about one thing. Doing undercover work is probably the most dangerous work you can do. And what's your experience about guys that don't do undercover work, have never done undercover work, trying to tell you how to do it? What do you think about that?
Well, my philosophy has always been, I don't try to have my, and I've been in management roles and stuff, I've never asked my group or my people or the people I directed to do anything that I hadn't done before in life, period.
Yeah.
I know we have people like that. And I can tell you, in one of my evaluations, I've had to, because I learned that, hey, the undercover person is the one that really calls the shots when it comes down to that. And I've had people in one of my evaluations early on, and I went to, I used to go to office to do undercover work, and people knowing, especially the police department, working in the police department, and they would try to stay something before you get there, so you think they're giving you a head start on the cases they want you to work on by having somebody to say, hey, you know, your cousin coming to town, or this and that and the other. Now, I had to step back from the office, and I got there and found out all this stuff had been laid down. I had nothing to do with it. None of my stories incorporated there.
Yeah.
I've got to now learn the script that somebody else wrote for themselves. And then I can't talk to the undercover, the cooperating individual, and get there and learn who they were. And I just told them, you got the wrong person here.
Yeah.
I got in my car and went back. Now I got money. I got money for that. And I had in my evaluation, somebody told me that I was a good agent, did a lot of work. But I gotten to the point that I couldn't accept criticism regardless of what intent it was given. And I should be transferred to a large office to broaden my experience. Now, I got that in one of my evaluations, but I know, now heard me say earlier, this is not a job that you got to preserve and look out for yourself. You don't look out, nobody else will look out for you. And there have been many people that I know who I've sat around and heard try to give directions of what to do, even tell you what to say, and had never done a day of undercover work. And, you know, if you gonna sit there and listen to somebody else and try to follow them, and you're not paying attention, so you're trying to remember the words, you're not trying to listen to the conversation you're having so you can adjust to those things, and that gets you in trouble.
But
I have pulled people to the side and say, hey, hold it. And when I was in charge, I tell people, look, no, this is the person who will interview whoever they're working with. They will talk to them. They will get whatever lines that they need. You let them do it. They tell us what's going on, so we know. But we didn't, just because you're the supervisor, you don't tell people what to say, what to do, not on that level. You know, you can make assignments, but not something like this.
I bet when you did that, I bet by that point in your career, you had gained that confidence to stand up to that. Because you can't all, you know, early on in your career, you don't really know how to manage a situation. But after you didn't experience this, you get to that point, you just said, fuck it. It's going to be this way or I'm out of here. And that's when you really start gaining your confidence, you know, as an agent. So I know it took some nerve to finally just step up there and do that. Because you probably hadn't always done that.
Well, and you were right. And you know, I can tell you a situation where early on in my career, I'd been at Swinton and I were working together, and I had been doing some undercover stuff. And it was getting around Christmas time, you know, around the Christmas holidays. And the office kept pushing me to go back and get another buy from this person. Keep on going back, go back, go back. And so I tried to tell them, this is not really the time, you know. But they pushed me to do that. And what happened was we already knew who the person was. We had already made a couple buys from them. But, you know, they wanted to lock them in. Okay, fine. Well, what happened was I went on and set the thing up anyway. And actually, I fronted the money because I knew who I was fronting to, because we had already had the guy. We know that kind of stuff. And that was
running the money. That was part of the operation plan.
No, it wasn't. See, this is what now you're coming to what we're talking about.
Okay.
But, now you know what we're talking about. But I'm just saying, those are the kind of experience you run into, but they were pushing you. And so even though I told them, hey, this is not the time to do it, how do at that point when I didn't have that confidence about, well, look here, you're my boss and you're telling me to go do this, you know what I'm saying? No, I ain't gonna do this. And I'm sitting there, hey, what do I do? You know, I didn't have that confidence. I'm going back, giving you an example of what you just saying.
Yeah.
And so that what happened was, again, I knew we weren't supposed to do that if it wasn't in the plan, but I also knew that we knew who the person was. It's not like a John Doe. This is not like somebody we've never seen before. We know where he lived, we know where everything. And I never thought that I would have to do that at the time. But they kept pushing me to say, go do it. And I was going, nah, it'd been okay if he said, well, look, I don't have it right now. Why don't I go get it and you come back later on? It wouldn't have been no problem, right? Mm-hmm. He said, well, why don't you, and maybe the guy had more sense than I did, which he did at the time. He said, okay, I got to go get it, but I need the money. Okay. So refund the money. I stayed right there waiting for him, and the guy never showed back up. Right?
Now, interesting.
I'm gonna tell you. I'm gonna tell you what happened. Because after he never showed up, we figured, hey, we know this guy. He's already he ain't coming back no more.
Yeah.
So. We had to make a decision, and we knew where the guy lived, and we went there, and I had to threaten him. That was part of the job, as being a dealer, right, undercover role.
Yeah.
Until the guy had gone and tied the money on a string. Opened his light switch, took the wall plate off, tied it on there, and dropped the money down behind the wall. So when we finally got in and got the guy arrested, the guy copped out and said, hey man, look here, it's Christmas time, my kids need toys and need this and that and the other, and da 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 da. And he need to make sure he get presents for it. You know, when I was telling people, this is not the time to go do stuff like, they didn't listen to me.
Yeah.
Now, but I'm still trying to make this deal happen, right? Well, it happened because we found out around arresting the guy when we weren't supposed to arrest the guy. And now I get myself in trouble because I had to front the money, because we had to arrest because I didn't have the money. I had already fronted the money.
Yeah.
So it these are the kind of lessons that you don't get out of a book.
Right.
These come from experiences, you know?
Yeah. Yes, that's true. Because you didn't, like you said initially, you weren't in that planning stage, because there could have been an opportunity where you could have fronted the money, and like you said, you knew who he was. And
yeah, but they said you didn't have permission. But you know, mm-hmm. And I know if you just meet him, you don't know, you have no way of getting them. But we had all that. I knew the manual, we had it. But then my point is, it wasn't an operation plan. And as a matter of fact, during that time, we weren't even writing operational plans like we used to do, like we did start learning. Do
later. It's verbal. The verbal plan. Verbal,
you know, you kind of, yeah, it's a verbal thing. So there's no way I can call them back and say, hey, then we didn't have cell phones. You know, yeah, beepers, we had the radio. You can't go to the car and say, hey, look here, can I front this money?
Pay phone.
You know, during those days. I mean, this is like, you know, like.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. So they made a big deal about you fronting the money, I'm sure.
Well, they did. I got written up. And at that point, I'm going to tell you, I was really emotionally disturbed in my own mind about what am I doing here? Because if they had listened to me and said, hey, let's not do this now, this ain't the time, then, but I figured, you know what, maybe I should have been more forceful and just say, look, I'm just not going to do it.
Yeah.
And, but I didn't. I tried to appease my bosses. I tried to do, you know, things that, you know, I didn't want to get into bad mind.
You tried to be a team player. Yeah. You tried to be a team player. Yeah. And ended up being
But then I get a letter of reprimand because I wanted the money. But we got the money back too though.
Yeah. Gerald Chapman, we go continue on where we left off. I'll see you next week. The Gladiator signing off.
The Gladiator.